It is Your Money. Welcome, welcome, welcome. I'm Susie Jones, along with Bruce Helmer, the founder of Wealth Enhancement Group and financial advisor. Good morning, Bruce. I understand Peg is off today.
Hi, Susie Jones. Yeah, Peg is taking a week off this week, so you and I will try to carry this by ourselves.
I think we'll do a grand job, to be honest with you.
I know you will.
I'm sure you will as well, my friend. So we're talking about 10 tips for your successful, happy retirement. I know this is right in my wheelhouse as I'm 62 and kind of starting to look around the corner and see what's next. Let's get jump right in, shall we?
Yeah, Susie, thanks for the lead in. That's excellent. And the first thing I want to say is, I looking at you, you don't look 62. Congratulations on that.
Oh, thank you.
But also, you hit on something really important. You know, probably the single biggest question that Peg and I receive and other financial advisors receive from people is some variation of the question, when can I retire? What age can I retire? And add to that, retire and not have to worry about running out of money before I die. So week after week on the shows that we do and in meetings with clients and prospective clients, this topic is prevalent and almost overarching on everything that we talk about. But it occurred to me, as much as we talk about it, I don't remember if ever, or at least recently, we ever gave a concise list of specific bullet points or tips for how to do this. And I know different people learn differently, but I learn or absorb information better, I think, if somebody says, okay, number one, do this, number two, or you can use the alphabet, A, B, but I like bullets, do one, you know, and specific steps. So today we came up with 10 tips for everybody, and that's the other thing I'm glad you mentioned. You're 62, but I think these tips are applicable whether you're 62, 52, 42. I think it doesn't matter what age you are. These are things that I think make sense universally for everybody listening to us today, and can help contribute to being able to retire when you want to, with the lifestyle that you want at retirement, and without ever having to worry about running out of money. So I'll go through this today and hopefully get this done in the first half of the show. We can leave the second half for questions from listeners. Last week we didn't get to many questions, and I promised to leave time to do that this week, and I don't want to violate my promise. So my list of 10 tips to contribute to your successful, happy retirement. Number one, I've got create a long-term plan. And again, listeners to the show have heard us talk about this before. Retirement or financial success or being able to retire when you want to doesn't just happen. You have to plan for it. You have to work at it. You have to put some time and effort into it. And there's a lot of statistical data about how people don't spend a lot of time doing this. They spend a lot more time doing things that in the big scheme of life probably aren't as important, but they just expect that, you know, they're going to be able to retire when they want, and they don't think about it. And I don't know if they don't think about it or they just don't know the right things to do, or if it's procrastination or avoidance. It's probably a lot of things, but create a long-term plan is number one. Retirement isn't really just a one-time event. Peg always says it's not like we deliver a financial plan and you plate it, you know, paint it in gold and put it on your mantle and look at it. It's an ongoing process. It's a 20 to 30 year journey that we have to stop and check every year after you retire and say, are we still where we want to be? Are we doing the right things? Do we need to make adaptations or course corrections? And so a long-term financial plan, retirement plan, would include projections where we try to anticipate expenses versus income. We make some assumptions on what your return on investment will be. We make some assumptions on the rate of inflation because costs won't stay the same. We make some assumptions in terms of withdrawal strategy. We've talked about this a lot on the show also, what I call the smart money strategy. When you retire, you want to always make sure you're spending the smartest money first, and we want to look at that every year because the smart money, you know, 1 year might not be the smart money the following year. We also need to look at risk management. We'll get more into that as I go through my top 10, but different insurances or protections. I always say it doesn't matter how much money you have. If it's vulnerable, if you could lose it, you have to dig a moat around your castle, so to speak, and protect your money. So number one, create a long-term plan. This doesn't just happen in a vacuum. Number two, I have the time to start saving and investing is now, right now, if you're not already doing it. It's amazing to me, Susie, and listeners, how often I get this question, well, when should I start saving for my retirement? And the answer is, it doesn't matter how old you are right now. If you have a job that has a 401k or some other type of retirement plan, even if you're in your 20s, you should try to find some extra money to contribute and participate in that retirement plan, particularly if there's some sort of a matching contribution. I tell people all the time in terms of prioritizing how you save and invest, for most people, it's not giving your money to someone like me, a financial advisor or a money manager. It's just participating in the company retirement plan, and especially if the employer has a matching contribution. I always tell people, look, if your plan gives you 50 cents on the dollar up to a certain percentage, which is typical of 401ks and other types of company retirement plans, that's a 50% rate of return. You put in a dollar, they give you 50 cents. I tell people all the time, look, we're good, but we're not going to make you a 50% return on investment. So participating in the company retirement plan, at least to get the employer match, is a high priority for a lot of savers and investors. And I would tell people also Roth. If you don't have a Roth option within your own plan, opening your own individual Roth IRA, again, especially for young people, is going to be very powerful. And the saving and investing that you should start as soon as possible, it should be diversified, not only from an asset class standpoint, which I think most listeners understand, but also from a tax diversification standpoint, which we talk about a lot on the show, but I don't think you can mention too often. You want some of your money going into investments that are fully and immediately taxable. You want some going into tax deferred, and you also want some that might be tax advantaged where maybe you avoid taxes completely, and that's the best example of that is the Roth. So number two, the time to start is right now. Number three, plan to finance a long life. I think, Susie, many retirees underestimate how long they're going to be retired. And it's changed a lot over the last couple generations, right? A couple generations ago, it was pretty typical that somebody would work until 65 and they'd pass away in their early 70s and they needed enough money to fund lifestyle, you know, for 6, 7, 8 years. Well, today, it is not uncommon that people want to retire earlier than 65, and they might live to be in their 80s or 90s, and now they have to fund 20 or even 30, or many cases even more than 30 years of retirement. You might spend as many years retired as you spent in the workforce, and your money's got to last as long as you do. So again, when we do that, it reemphasizes the point of starting as soon as possible. It emphasizes the point of we have to factor in things like inflation, that costs are not going to remain constant. We have to factor in things that we're going to have health care expenses as we get older, as we age, things start to go wrong with our bodies that might cost us money. All those things come into play if we plan to finance this for a long time, and going back to number one, as part of our long-term plan. Number four, I have plan and live your legacy. And what we mean by this is oftentimes in our world, we talk about estate planning. And I think there's a lot of people that when they listen to me or they listen to other financial people talk about estate planning, they kind of tune out because they think, I don't have a large estate. I don't need to do estate planning. Well, I prefer the term legacy planning. To me, they're synonymous, but I think legacy planning is more accurate and captures the essence of what we're trying to do, in that unless you spend your last dollar the day you take your last breath, which most of us are not going to be able to do, there's going to be something left. And estate planning or legacy planning just means that whatever's left, where do we want it to go? And how do we get it there efficiently and effectively and as quickly as possible with the least amount of taxes. And you can plan for this. You can do this. It's a combination of just having a plan, of having beneficiary designations, of having the proper legal documents, whether it's a will or a revocable trust. And then we've also talked in recent weeks, Susie, and listeners a lot, and we're going to keep, you know, repeating this theme. Peg and I have both talked about the phenomenon that we have of existing clients that don't spend enough. And I know that sounds crazy. I think most people think you probably have clients that spend too much and they're going to run out of money. I occasionally get that, and I have to, you know, set a client down and tell them they need to slow down. But it's way more common that we have clients that have things they want to do, bucket list. I'm doing air quotes around bucket list. They have things that they want to do, and they have the economic wherewithal to do them, but they're not doing them. So part of legacy planning is not just after we leave this world and the legacy we leave behind, but it's living our legacy. It's taking advantage of our hard work and our commitment to saving and investing and having a plan and enjoying our retirement. It's you can't even make this stuff up. I've been spending some time this weekend with an old friend that I hadn't seen in a while, and we were talking about this literally yesterday, and I said, what are things that you and your wife still want to do before you leave this world? And at first he struggled to come up with an answer, and then as we chatted longer, he started coming up with some things, or I kind of led him down a road, and he said, yeah, we'd like to do this, we'd like to do this. And I said, what are you waiting for? I mean, none of us is promised tomorrow. If you both really want to go do those things, go do them. So number four, plan and live your legacy. Number five I have, don't ignore long-term care planning and life insurance. Now, long-term care, will be very candid. Over my career, I've had a lot of people that we've recommended long-term care insurance, and they maybe have died healthy and never filed a claim against it, and they spent a lot of money on premium to get an insurance policy that they never used. And or we've seen long-term care insurance premiums go up. But I've also had experiences where we've recommended long-term care, and it's been a financial lifesaver for the client because they did need it, and they used it, and it paid benefits that otherwise would have been financially devastating to them. So I will always say to anybody and everybody, and publicly and one-on-one meetings, not everybody should buy long-term care insurance, but everybody should do long-term care planning. That may include insurance, it may not. It may include self-insuring that risk, but then that means accumulating enough assets that you've got money set aside for that potential future cost. With regard to life insurance, that's another one that people don't want to talk about and people instinctively or inherently don't like. Life insurance generally has two primary motivations, I think, for people. Number one, as an income replacement, when you're young, you're married, you're raising your family, you have a mortgage, you have other expenses, you have these children to raise, and if something happens to one of the members of the partnership, now you've got, if they worked outside the home, you've got that lost income, and now you've not only got this sadness and this tragedy of having to deal with the loss of a loved one, but now you've also got financial challenges. So you have life insurance for an infusion of capital to help pave the way or ease the road for the survivors. But eventually that desire goes away. You accumulate enough assets, you've got enough money that if one of you predeceases the other, the survivor's got enough money to live, the kids are launched. And so the need for that type of that reason for life insurance goes away. But there may be other reasons to keep life insurance later in life besides replacing lost income. It's a great strategy for estate equalization, for funding trust, to give a bigger legacy to loved ones, kids, grandkids, and charities. So you may not need life insurance, but you may want life insurance for any number of different reasons. And in that case, if we're going to use that as a strategy, I tell people all the time, it doesn't benefit you, it benefits others, but you have the economic wherewithal to be able to do it if those are priorities to you, if you want to leave more to loved ones, if you want to leave more to charity. So again, number five, don't ignore long-term care planning and your life insurance. Number six, I have understand and manage Social Security options. Again, we've talked about this a lot on this program. I won't go through the whole thing because we can literally do an entire show on Social Security. In fact, a lot of these 10 things we probably could do an entire show on. But Social Security, as most listeners know, you've got an 8-year window from 62 to 70 when you can draw your benefits. But it's not that simple. There's a lot of other variables. Does your partner also have Social Security? What other assets do you have? What are your expenses that you want when you retire? Are you going to fund your lifestyle with your investments or Social Security or both? So when you exercise that and how you exercise that is a very important decision. It's never going to be an exact science because we don't know exactly when we're going to die. But again, standard operating procedure at Wealth Enhancement, we help our clients deal and navigate that road to understand and manage their Social Security options. Number seven, I have, without your health, you have nothing. Look, a person with health has 1,000 dreams. A person without health has one. Prioritize health. Money and health go together. A happy, successful retirement go together. Prioritize diet and exercise. See your doctor. I get an annual physical. I have an annual visit to a dermatologist. I get this stuff checked every year. As you get to my age, it's important to do that. Stay active socially, mentally, physically. Integrate health into your overall planning. Without your health, you've got nothing. It doesn't matter how much money you have. If you're too unhealthy to do anything and enjoy life, the money's just a legacy asset. It doesn't assist in a healthy, happy retirement lifestyle. Number eight, Susie and listeners, I have gift while you're alive. And what I mean by this, again, is people that have the economic wherewithal to be generous and give to a charity or charities of their choice, or their children or grandchildren or other loved ones, oftentimes take the approach that I heard Bruce and Peg, you know, talking about estate planning or legacy planning, so I've got a plan in place of who's going to get what when I die, and I listened to them and I did that. But you know what? And I'm going to use myself as the example here and my own children. My children, I'm blessed to have wonderful, great children. I know they don't listen to my show, but if they are, I'm very proud of both of my kids. And they don't ask me for anything, and frankly, they don't need anything. They are launched. They are doing well. I gift to them every year anyway, and at first they gave me some pushback saying, Dad, this is too generous. Dad, we don't need this. Dad, you should enjoy your own, you know, all these reasons. And again, I give them great credit that that's their attitude, that they're not, you know, asking me for things. They want to be independent. They want to make their own way. But my response back to them is, look, when I leave this world, yes, you're going to inherit from me, but I'm not going to be here to enjoy it or to see it. I want a gift now because it makes my heart happy. Let me have this joy of giving, because even when you're in your 20s and 30s, as my children are, I can't think of very many 20-some-year-old or early 30-some-year-old, no matter how well they're doing, that couldn't use more money. So I like to gift while I'm alive. It makes my heart happy, and I have a lot of clients that do the same thing. It's a little bit different than planning your future legacy. They're combined, and frankly, all 10 of these items are sort of combined when you really get down to it. Number nine, I have, when you retire, roll over your 401k. Accumulating money for retirement is only part of the story. The other part is distribution or retirement income planning, or spending the smart money first with the Wealth Enhancement Smart Money Strategy. And we're much better able to provide income, and we have more choices for strategies if we are no longer in the company retirement plan. All company retirement plans, even really, really good ones, have a very restricted number of investment choices, and most of those investment choices are focused towards growth. But when you retire, your priority might not be growth anymore. It might be preservation of what you've got. It might be income. So you still want growth, but maybe it's not as important in your 60s and 70s as it was in your 30s and 40s and 50s. So for most people, when they retire, they're going to want to convert their 401k. Now, again, there's other things to look at. There's costs. There's other assets. There's tax efficiencies and so forth. But when you retire, at least look at what are the possibilities of things you can do with your 401k. And then number 10, understand and manage your pension. So we're seeing fewer and fewer pensions than we used to, but they're still out there. And how are you going to take your pension? When are you going to take it? Are you going to take a single life option? Are you going to take a joint life option? Are you going to set it up so if you predecease your spouse, there's something there for your spouse? How, do you understand your pension? Do you understand the options? Again, at Wealth Enhancement, reviewing and advising clients on their pension options is standard operating procedure, and it's a very important thing to do if you still have one of those. Again, pension is really a defined benefit plan. They've largely been replaced by 401ks or defined contribution plans. But if you're one of those out there that still has a pension, it's important to understand it and manage it. Susie, I know we're about out of time for the first segment. When we come back, I'll just do a quick review of my 10 tips. And then most of the second half, we can let listeners drive the show.
That sounds great. 651-461-9226. A lot of good information. 10 tips for your successful and happy retirement. The number to call if you have a question for Bruce Helmer, who is flying solo today, 651-461-9226. 651-461-9226. You can use that line to text Bruce, or you can also call. We'd love to have you on the air if you're at that retirement age. Maybe you're already been retired a few years and you want to jump in. Please give us a call. And we are back for the second half of Your Money. I'm Susie Jones, along with Bruce Helmer, the founder of Wealth Enhancement Group and financial advisor. Peg is off this week, and we're talking about 10 tips for your successful and happy retirement. Bruce went through them in the first half hour, and he's back now once again to recap briefly, and then we want to talk to you, 651-461-9226. That's 651-461-9226. That is our talk and text line. We already do have a number of text questions coming in, as a lot of people are on the cusp or maybe already retired. 651-461-9226. Bruce, take it away.
Thank you, youthful Susie Jones. Appreciate that. I'll quickly just repeat these 10 things in case people want to write them down or take notes. I'm not going to go into the same level of detail that I did in the first half, but my 10 tips for your successful and happy retirement. Number one, have a long-term plan. Number two, the time to start saving and investing is now. Number three, plan to finance a long life. We're statistically speaking, you know, good news, bad news. Good news is we're living longer than ever before. The bad news is we're living longer than ever before, and our money's got to last longer when we retire than it did a couple generations ago. Number four, plan and live your legacy. Legacy planning applies to everyone. It doesn't matter how big or small your estate is. We're all going to probably have something left when we leave this world. We want to get it where we want it to go as efficiently as we can. Number five, don't ignore long-term care planning and life insurance. Number six, understand and manage your Social Security benefit options. Number seven, focus on your health. Without our health, we have nothing. It doesn't matter how much money we have. If we're so unhealthy, all we can do is sit around and watch the world go by. When you retire, you want to be able to go out and live life and have the health to do it. Number eight, gift while you're alive, if you have the economic wherewithal to do so. Number nine, when you retire, look at your company retirement plan and consider your options of what you should do with it. And number 10, understand and manage your pension options if you're one of those with a pension. When we retire, our income is going to be made up basically of our own savings and investments. For most people, Social Security, and maybe if you're one of those that has some sort of a pension plan or defined benefit plan with your employer. So that's my 10 things. I think they apply to everybody listening, regardless of where you're at. If you're already retired, if you're a long ways away from retirement, I think these things probably make sense for everybody. And Susie, let's get as many listener questions as we can. And I've got a couple compiled over the weeks of things that I've heard more than one time, but we didn't get to on the show. I'll use those if we need some extras, but let's start with what people are asking today.
All right. 651-461-9226. A texter writes, so gifting your kids while you're alive gives the gifter a tax advantage. How does it affect the recipient's tax obligation? Are you extending the burden to them? How does that work?
So that's a good question, and it's partly correct, but it's partly not correct. So gifting does not give me a tax advantage. When I gift, it's really just prematurely using my lifetime exclusion for my estate. And I live in the state of Minnesota, so there's one level of assets that you can exclude without any taxes. Then at the federal level, that number is much, much higher. Gifting is really just doing that in advance. So there's no immediate tax benefit for the giver of the gift. And the receiver of the gift, there's no tax consequence either, as long as that gift under current tax law is not over $19,000. So we can gift to loved ones or others. It doesn't even have to be a relative. It could be a friend. It could be a stranger. If people want to gift to me and send me checks, there's one Ellen Helmer, H-E-L-M-E-R. I'll gladly take your gifts. I'm kidding, of course. But you can gift up to $19,000 per year per person, Susie and listeners, without any impact to the giver or to the receiver. And I want to elaborate on this a little bit, because this is often an area of confusion. I'm not saying most people listening right now have the ability economically to do this, but you could actually gift. Let's say that you're married and your adult child is married. You could gift $19,000 to your child, and your spouse could gift $19,000 to your child, and you could gift $19,000 to your child's spouse, and your spouse could gift $19,000. So it's really, what is that, $76,000 that you could gift to one family in one tax year without any tax consequence to the giver or to the receiver. Now, I recognize most of us don't have $76,000 just lying around to give to our kids, but legally, you could. You can gift up to $19,000 per year per person without any tax considerations to either the giver or the receiver. Susie?
651-461-9226. Does it make sense, this texter writes, for a 70-year-old to buy a life insurance policy that would be offset by the tax liability on an IRA for his beneficiaries?
That's a really smart question, and the answer is it might, but let me dive into that because it's really a good question, and I referenced it a little bit in the first half of the show. So probably most people, when they reach the age of 70, prevailing wisdom would say you don't need to go buy life insurance when you're 70, because again, most people think of life insurance as something they need when they're younger, when they have a mortgage, when they have other debt, other expenses, their kids aren't launched yet, they have the expense of raising children, and they're afraid if one or both members of the partnership died prematurely in an accident or an illness, that financially that could be devastating. We know it's going to be emotionally devastating, but it might also be financially devastating. So we have life insurance that if that tragedy happens, somebody dies prematurely, we have an infusion of capital to help us navigate the costs of life and replace that lost income if they worked outside the home. And by the way, that's the other thing. Even if two partners together, one works outside the home and the other does not, just because somebody doesn't earn a paycheck does not mean they don't have economic value. What are they doing for your household that if they weren't there anymore, you'd have to hire somebody to do the things that they did to keep the household running, getting the kids to school, getting groceries, you know, whatever. So both partners, whether you get a paycheck or not, have economic value to that partnership. So you have life insurance to get an infusion of capital if tragedy strikes. Well, as I said in the first half of the show, you might get to a certain age where you've accumulated enough assets now that if one of you predeceases the other, the survivor's got enough money that they're going to be fine. And also maybe your kids now are launched and you don't have those expenses. Maybe your mortgage is paid off and you just don't need the big death benefit that you needed when you were younger. But as a legacy planning asset or an estate planning asset or as a way of being able to leave more to loved ones and or charities, life insurance could still be a viable strategy. And the texter actually kind of understands this. So if you have tax-deferred money, Susie and listeners, again, whether it's a company retirement plan or a traditional IRA, if you've got money that in a plan that you funded with pre-tax dollars, so there was no taxes paid on the contributions that you made to the plan, and now the earnings or growth on that plan have not been taxable, we defer the taxes until you actually take withdrawals from that plan. That's a very traditional tax-deferred, traditional IRA, traditional 401k, retirement plans, tax deferral, deduction for the contribution, no taxes on the earnings or the growth, no 1099s, but they're taxable when you spend it. But they're also taxable if you leave it to the next generation. So if I have a big IRA and I'm taking withdrawals to assist with my retirement income, I'm paying taxes on those withdrawals. But if I die and I leave that to my children, now they have to take the money out of that IRA. They can't just leave it there or roll it over or defer it. They've got to take money out of it. In fact, they have to take enough out that they deplete that account balance in its entirety over a 10-year period of time, and that's taxable to them at whatever their tax bracket or whatever their tax rate is. So these tax-deferred plans, while I certainly like them and I never discourage participation in them, I also always talk about tax diversification and having other options of where you can go get retirement income from, because there's a tax lien on all this money, both for you when you spend it and for the next generation when they inherit it. What the texter is talking about, I think, is what if you these IRA withdrawals, it's more money than you need for your lifestyle. Susie, I have a lot of clients that don't need their IRA, wouldn't even touch their IRA if it wasn't for the fact that there's required minimum distributions and the government mandates that they have to take withdrawals out of it so the government can collect the taxes on it. Well, if you don't need that money or you don't need all of it, a possibly effective strategy to enhance your charitable giving and or to leave a bigger legacy to your loved ones is to say, I'm going to take the withdrawals that I have to take out of my IRA and take part of it, or if I don't need any of it, I have a lot of clients that don't need any of it, I'm going to take the net that's left over on that withdrawal after I pay my taxes and use that to fund a life insurance policy. And again, I could hear people listening right now going, whoa, hold the phone, Homer. What are you doing? What, you trying to sell life insurance to old people? What's wrong with you? They don't need life insurance. No, they don't need it, but they might want it. It might help them leave a bigger legacy. They're taking this IRA money, they would have a tax lien on it if their kids get it, and they're taking distributions and they're buying life insurance that the kids will get without a tax lien on it. Life insurance, by law, life insurance death benefits that go to a beneficiary are not taxable events. Life insurance is income tax free. So as a planning strategy, it's not something that you would do for yourself to enhance your retirement income or to enhance your lifestyle, but it might be a strategy that you want if you have more money than you need, and yes, that there are actually people that are in that situation, and you want to leave more to kids, grandkids, charities, whatever. It can be a very effective financial planning strategy to leave more behind after you leave this world, and yes, I have recommended life insurance before in situations like this to somebody 70 years old or older, because if you said, what if we took this money and invested it and grew it and applied earnings to it, they're never going to live long enough that that investment is going to grow to be tax-free what that life insurance death benefit would be. So it's a totally different reason or mindset for life insurance than what people typically think about. But in that circumstance that I just described, and I think that's what the texter's asking about, it actually can be a very, very effective strategy for leaving more behind after you leave this world.
Susie? All right. 651-461-9226. A texter writes, I turned 59 and a half next week. Should I start a Roth conversion this year? I am still working.
Great question. So there's a lot of kind of milestone or benchmark ages that people are very aware of. 59 and a half is one of them. And for listeners that don't know, 59 and a half is kind of the magical age where these tax-deferred and tax-advantaged plans, you have more flexibility, more liquidity, more accessibility to these plans at 59 and a half. On a traditional IRA or traditional 401k or any of these tax-deferred types of plans, and there's others out there, 403Bs and it's 457s, et cetera. If you generally speaking, with very few exceptions, if you take a withdrawal or a disbursement before 59 and a half, you're not only going to pay ordinary income taxes, which is always the case. We just talked about that. There's always a tax lien on those dollars. But if you're younger than 59 and a half, there may also be an additional 10% penalty on top of the ordinary income tax rate. Therefore, we highly recommend that the vast, vast, vast majority of people don't touch these plans or don't use this money before 59 and a half. At 59 and a half, now you've got a lot more flexibility. Now you can take disbursements. You're still going to pay taxes, but you're going to avoid this 10% penalty. What the texter, though, is asking with regard to Roth conversion, hitting the age of 59 and a half is not necessarily a magic wand or a silver bullet. It doesn't really do anything in terms of making Roth conversions more or less efficient. What we look at when we look at the issue of Roth conversion is, what is the cost to do the conversion? And again, for listeners that don't know, Roth conversion means I'm going to take this traditional IRA or this tax-deferred plan, and I'm going to take a disbursement or a withdrawal, and I'm going to put that money into a Roth where no future tax will be due as long as I leave it in there for at least 5 years or until 59 and a half, whichever is longer. I can convert an asset from a tax-deferred to a tax-advantaged or avoid the taxes completely. But it's not free to do that. The amount I convert is taxable. When I take money out of that traditional IRA, I can move it to a Roth, but I've got to pay the taxes on it. So one of the things we look at is, what is the cost or at what tax rate would we be doing that? And just because I'm 59 and a half, if I'm still working and my income is the same or more this year than what it was last year, and it didn't make sense last year because the cost was too great, it's not going to suddenly make sense now just because I hit 59 and a half. So that 59 and a half is one of those benchmarks. There's a lot of other benchmarks. 73 is the age of required minimum distribution. So right now on tax deferred accounts, you basically have a window where you have a lot more flexibility from 59 and a half to 73. 59 and a half is the age where you have more accessibility without the 10% penalty. But at 73, you lose some flexibility again because there's a minimum you must withdraw every year. Uncle Sam insists on it. But that window in between, you've got a lot more flexibility. And I think what the texter was thinking is that to do a conversion before they're 59 and a half might incur a 10% penalty, but it doesn't. You can be 30 years old and say, I'm going to convert some traditional IRA to Roth, and it's not considered a distribution. It does not come with a 10% penalty on it. Now, as I say that out loud, I'm second-guessing myself. I think that's right, but I'll double-check that, and if I'm wrong, I'll correct it next week. So Basically, I don't think 59 and a half matters, but even as I went through that long-winded answer now, no, I'm wondering if I got it right. I'll double check that, Susie.
All right. A texter writes at 651-461-9226, and this is kind of my question too for myself, so I'm getting a twofer. When you're ready to retire and get an income, is it better? Is it a Roth? Do you take money out of a Roth, a taxable, or a tax advantage account, or a pension? How do you determine what buckets you're taking money out of to pay yourself during retirement?
Susie, thank you. And texter listener, thank you. That is such a good question. So, again, the answer is it depends, but let me give some possible scenarios here. So now and this is why I talk about and why I'm so emotional and so insistent about trying to achieve tax diversification. So let's say, and I told this story on the show a few weeks back, I encountered a person not so long ago that was retired from my industry that did a great job of accumulating wealth. They had over $5 million in an IRA, but that IRA was basically all that they had. And they called me up and I said, you're in the industry and you have $5 million. Why are you talking to me? And they said, is there a way that the taxes are killing me? My required minimum distribution, this person was in their 70s, my required minimum distribution is throwing me into a high tax bracket. How do I avoid it? And the answer is you can't, because you don't have any tax diversification. So sometimes it is smart to spend tax deferred money. So let me give you an example. Let's say that the amount of income that you want out of your investments in a particular year at retirement, let's say it's $20,000. You're getting Social Security. You may or may not be getting a pension, but all your sources of income that are kind of locked in, you still want to take an additional $20,000 from your investments, and you have some money in taxable accounts, some money in tax deferred, some in tax advantage, like a Roth. So we look at it and we say, well, we can actually take out $10,000 out of your tax deferred account, and you're at the 12% tax bracket. But if you go over $10,000, anything over that is going to be at a 22% tax bracket. We don't want to jump 10% on the tax rate. So let's take the first $10,000 out of the 20 that you need out of a tax deferred account. Let's go get the other 10 either out of a tax free Roth or maybe out of a taxable account, because I think, as most listeners understand, if I have a taxable account like money in the bank or a brokerage account, whatever I earn during the year, I get a 1099 on those earnings anyway. So if I spend the money or don't spend the money, the tax consequence is pretty insignificant because I get a 1099 anyway. So the answer is it's a combination of withdrawal from my tax deferred account and one of my others, taxable or tax advantaged. But again, that's going to be different every year, which is why I say retirement income planning is not a set it and forget it strategy. It's something that you look at every year, because the smart money or the best money that you spent last year might not be the best this year. Now, I'll add one more thing, just because we probably don't have time for another question anyway. Tax efficiency is one of the things that we look at. And again, you don't even have that option for tax efficiency unless you have tax diversification. But the other thing we look at is the results of the investment. So if your stocks are way, way up and there's a lot of gains and you need money, let's go sell some stocks. If it's a year where stocks are way down, we might say, let's leave those alone and give them a chance to recover, and let's go pull money out of your money market or something else. So again, tax efficiency, investment efficiency, spending the smart money first, you need to at retirement, you literally need to look at it every year.
All right. Bruce, we are out of time and a lot of questions still to come here. So we'll ask people that are listening and have called in to call this number, 1-888-6-ADVICE, or you can email questions to yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com. Bruce, have a wonderful day.
You do the same. Everybody have a great day out there.
All right. We'll talk to you next week. It is Your Money on WCCO. It is 856.